Today's Taisho will be on Case 18 in the Wumenquan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 18 is entitled Tozan's Three Chin of Flax. A monk asked Tozan, "What is Buddha?" Tozan replied, "Three Chin of Flax." Mumon's comment, "Old Tozan attained the Zen of a poor clam. He opened the two halves of the shell a little and exposed the liver and intestines inside. But tell me, how do you see Tozan?" Mumon's verse, "Three chin of flax came sweeping along. Close were the words, but closer was the meaning. Those who argue about right and wrong are enslaved by right and wrong." Some of you are here for the first time, and some of you have been coming here for many years. This is called a koan. In this tradition of Zen meditation, we practice with koans. That is, we use these for questions or stories for meditation as ways of working through our barriers. I'd like to say a little bit about the way koans work and a little bit about Zen in general. When I read this story, it's very brief. A monk asks Master Tozan, "What is the Buddha?" And Tozan says, cryptically, "Three jin of flax." A jin is like a unit of weight, so like 3 pounds of flax. So a monk says to Tozan, this is somebody who's at a temple, he's given up his life, he's practicing meditation day and night in order to wake up. And he comes to the teacher and he says to the teacher, "What is Buddha?" And Tozan says this line that doesn't make any sense, 3 pounds of flax. And that's the story. And then there's a commentary by the editor, Master Mumon, and there's a verse that I read. Now, all the koans are sort of like this. They don't really make any sense the first time you read them through, and maybe the 50th time you read them through. You're really supposed to use them for meditation purposes. I'll have more to say about that. There's something about the style of Zen teaching which I think is quite important and that many people don't appreciate. I had a conversation a few weeks ago with somebody who's been a student of mine for 10 years. And he said, "I hope you won't mind if I'm critical." He said, "But you know, I've been studying Zen with you for 10 years, and I don't know anything about Buddhism." I actually started laughing. But I can understand why he feels that way. You know, if you come here on a Saturday, and you do meditation, and you stay for the talk, you know, I never talk about things like the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, you know. Never. I don't think I've ever talked about that. I never talk about the precepts. I don't think I've ever given a Dharma talk on the precepts. And so, you know, I understand why this person felt like basically, he was getting nowhere with his study of the Dharma, study of Buddhism. You know, instead, he was coming and he was sitting and he was listening to these talks. And these talks are about, you know, going to the store, or about somebody I know, or about, you know, the time I was a carpenter, or hitchhiking across the United States. And, you know, it's possible to listen to these talks and think, where's the Dharma? You know, where's the Buddhism in these talks? But I'm not alone in this. If I'm guilty, I'm not the only one. You know, if you think I'm bad, you should have heard a talk by Genki Roshi. Because, you know, people do come up to me at the end of the Taisho and they say, you really wrapped it up at the end. But Genki Roshi didn't wrap it up. It was just stories. And we'd sit there and we'd listen and we'd listen. And he'd say, you know, I was down throwing pots. And he'd say, you know, the coarse clay is better than the fine clay, you know. And then you think, ah, he's making a point. See, the coarse clay is better than the fine clay. Maybe, you know, the rougher life is better than the refined life or something like that. But then after a while you realize, no, he's just talking about clay. You know, and then he would talk about something else. He'd say, oh, you know, I just got the best skimono, the best pickles, you know, and he'd tell you where you could get the best pickles. And you're waiting for the payoff, and there doesn't seem to be any payoff. And it can be frustrating, you know. And so, you know, it was, at times you would just think, what was that about? What was that about? You know, I've been reading, I read quite a few books about the by the Dalai Lama, whom I really respect. And the Dalai Lama he's a very good writer. He's obviously a charming person. He lays everything out so methodically. You know, he'll say, there's three theories of why this is so. And he'll tell you about the people in Indian philosophy who created those theories. And then he'll say, this is why I think this is the right one and this is the wrong one, and so on. And at the end of the chapter, you really do have a good intellectual understanding. A good intellectual understanding. And so, you know, if you want to understand Buddhism, you know, I really hope you will get a book. There's a wonderful book called What the Buddha Taught by a Theravada monk. And it's just like an introduction to the Buddha's teaching in the Pali Canon. If you want to understand the Mahayana, you know, there's a lot of books you can read. You can read those things and get a lot out of that. And I actually urge you to do that. You know, I definitely think Zen people should read the sutras. So I highly recommend reading the Diamond Sutra. I highly recommend reading, you know, the Shurangama Sutra sometime, if you have time to read it. Because these are really important documents in the history of Zen. If you really feel like you're ambitious, you might read the Lankavatara Sutra, which is the Sutra Bodhidharma brought from China. But my guess is that when you try to read these sutras, you're going to put them down in frustration. Because, you know, you're not going to understand what they have to say. You know, there's a certain kind of person who wants answers, and who wants a system, and who wants it all laid out, you know? And I respect that kind of person. I really do. The Dalai Lama's tradition, you know, they lay it all out in very clear, logical, methodical steps. And there's a kind of beginner, often a beginner, who really craves that. You know, sometimes people come to something like Buddhism or Zen because they feel very confused and they want somebody to give them the answers. They want somebody to give them the answers. So, you know, you could sit down with somebody and say, look, you know, all, life is suffering, you know, and there's a way out of suffering, and so on. And you could tell them about the Eightfold Path, and they could actually take this home and hold on to it. They could memorize the Four Noble Truths, they could memorize the Eightfold Path, and they could feel they're getting somewhere, you know. Beginners especially like that. You know, it gives, now I've got something I can hang on to. See? And that's a wonderful thing. I'm not criticizing that. But, you know, that creates problems over time. Sometimes I teach literature. And I will be teaching a work of, like a novel. I very rarely do it anymore, but I used to do it a lot. And I'd be teaching a novel, somebody would die. And, you know, often I would teach this novel to undergraduates, you know, who might be 18, 19 years old. And this novel is a really brilliant discussion of what death means. But I once asked my students, how many of you have experienced death in your life? You know, how many? Almost nobody. You know, they're 18 years old. Almost nobody had experienced having somebody they love die. You know, if they read that novel 25 years later, they would be sobbing into their hands. But, when you give it to 18-year-olds who have been relatively insulated from this experience, you know, it's a shallow event, you know. Sometimes I read things now that I read in college, and they move me to tears, and at the time I just thought, eh. Because I hadn't gotten the life experience to make these things real to me, you know. But, you know, those 18-year-olds, including myself, you know, I read this novel when I was in college, and nobody that I knew had died. You know, I read this and I thought, oh, I understand what death is about. See, I understand what death is about. I read about it. You know, the dying process. I read a book, The Dying Process, you know, maybe. The three stages of dying, or the five stages of dying. I know all about it. But actually, I didn't really know anything about it until many years later, when I was 39 years old, my father died. You know, and I saw this guy who was 6'1", 250 pounds, turn into somebody who was about 5'8", and about 140 pounds. You know, and I held him in my arms when he died. Now I understand what death is, see? So, you know, if people, if you study, you read books on Buddhism, please do. And I really am not being ironic or sarcastic, please do. You know, read some books about basic Buddhist ideas. If you have people who all do that, and that's all they do, it becomes a very shallow situation, you know? So, a lot of people I'm going to criticize. I guess there's no way around it, you know. I have a lot of friends who are Theravada people. That is, they're from Sri Lanka, or mostly from Sri Lanka. And they're like what are called Protestant Buddhists, you know. That's actually Protestant Buddhists. Buddhist scholars call them the Protestant Buddhists because they read the scriptures, but they treat it like a holy writ. But they don't do much meditation, right? You know, and if you hang out with them and you're a meditation teacher, you begin to tear your hair out because their understanding of the Dharma is so shallow. Right? So shallow. If somebody dies, they all nod and they go, ah, yes, impermanence. See, ah, impermanence. It's all explained then. Great. No problem. Right? See, that way of living is very shallow. And their practice of the Dharma is very, very shallow, those Protestant Buddhists. You know, they just read a book and they think they understand. See? And if you haven't read the book, you might actually feel envious of them. You know, somebody might say, well, it's the Eightfold Path. And you might say, the Eightfold Path, what's that? And somebody could turn and say, you call yourself a Buddhist and you don't even know what the Eightfold Path is? Somebody could refer to the Triple Gem or the Three Gems. You might not know what they are. Oh my God, I thought I was a Buddhist and I didn't even know. See? So, you know, this is the situation, I think, among a lot of Sri Lankans now, and it was kind of the situation in a lot of China when Zen began. There were lots of people who had an intellectual understanding of Buddhism, but it was very shallow, very shallow. And, you know, people like to talk about Buddhism. They like to talk about Buddhist concepts and ideas, but it hadn't soaked into their flesh and their bones, see. And I've had this experience myself. You know, a number of years ago, this was a number of years ago, like 20 years ago, not too long ago, I was associating with people from theologians, Jewish and Christian theologians. And they invited me to be part of this circle, and I could only stand to be in the circle for like a couple visits. And then I wanted to throw myself out the window. Because everybody was talking, you know, God this, God that, God this, God that. And I just felt like screaming, you know. You know, as soon as you say this word, you act like you understand something, but you're just pulling ideas out of a book. You know, that's not really knowledge. That's not really knowing in your flesh and your bones, right? That's a simulation, a simulacrum of understanding. See, and in fact, this was the case in China. And the great, you know, the probably one of the greatest Zen masters of all time was Master Joshu, Zhao Zhou. And Joshu used to say, I can't even stand to hear the word Buddha. Yeah? Now, don't get me wrong. Joshu was the deepest practitioner in hundreds of years of the Buddha's way. But he didn't like to hear Buddha this and Buddha that. See? Because that's not real knowledge. So, you know, there is such a thing as an intellectual understanding of Buddhism, and I think you should acquire it. It's good to read basic books and understand some of the basic principles or basic teachings. But on the other hand, that's no substitute for the real understanding that in your flesh and in your bones of the Dharma. See? So you know, an intellectual understanding isn't the same as in your flesh and bones knowing. So let me give you an example. In Buddhism, there are these rules that are called precepts. Precepts. So the Buddha basically said that there are rules you should try to follow. And one of them, you know, when people take a Dharma name, they take the precepts. And the precepts include don't kill somebody, don't steal, you have to be sexually responsible, you could say. You know. So you take a vow not to be sexually careless or sexually callous. And so there's a prohibition basically against sexual misdeeds, right? So you know, you could have taken the precepts. But, you know, what does it really mean to say, I won't steal, or I won't engage in sexually inappropriate behavior? So let's say you're in a relationship with somebody. And then, you know, one day you go out to lunch and you meet somebody who absolutely sweeps you off your feet. See? And you're filled with desire for this person. Now, you could say, wait a minute, the precepts say not to do this. But my feeling is that rules or laws are like sand before the mighty waves, right? In this case, I think, you know, if you just say, well, I can't do this because the precepts says no, I think your resolve may quickly be eroded. Laws, rules, don't make people virtuous. Cultivation makes people virtuous. See? So if you feel lust, inappropriate desire, you can say, I am not supposed to feel this desire. But you still feel the desire. Now what do you do? See? So we have something called Zazen, seated meditation. You know, to practice Zen is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to become one with the 10,000 things. So if you feel inappropriate desire, you could say, I'm not supposed to feel it, but there it is. And it's usually very powerful. So what do you do? Well, if you practice Zen, you say, where is my desire coming from? You see, you pursue it, the question as a koan, and you look to the sources of your desire. This is Zen practice. If you feel illegitimate or a destructive desire, you know, you can't just stop yourself. Hey, I'm not supposed to feel this. You feel it. And usually the characteristic of desire is that it's overwhelming. So when you sit down on the cushion, you investigate the source. And you realize, you know, this is really not about sex, perhaps. You know, maybe this is about my feeling of not being valued in my relationship. Or maybe you feel, I'm getting older, and I feel that life is slipping away. And I feel that I'm an unworthy person, and I haven't achieved anything. Or, I'm lonely. Or, you know, you begin to get insight into the sources of your actions and feelings. Now, this is so much better than having a rule, right? To practice Zen is to study the self, to find the sources of your emotions, of your thoughts, of your desires. This is how we cultivate the self. If you are overwhelmed by, say, desire, you know, and it's not appropriate, and you need to understand the sources of your desire, and you inspect your heart, you inspect your mind, and you realize eventually, if you sit in Ushin, in blank mind, you eventually see the sources of your desire. You know, as I say, it may have nothing. It's not really about sex. It's about so many things. It's about loss. It's about never feeling valued, low self-esteem. It's about the desire to own something when you've never had anything of your own. So many sources, so many roots. You know. Now this is worth so much. This insight is liberating, because at some point, you know, you start with your desire, you sit in Mushin, you understand the sources of your desire, and at some point, you enter emptiness. And when you enter emptiness, you are liberated. your heart grows calm, your mind grows steady, see? And now you can say, no, this is not right. This is not right. See, no rule on earth will give you that insight. See, the Buddha did give people precepts, but he said what liberates people is understanding. But it's not intellectual understanding. It's the whole body understanding, heart understanding. So when we sit down on the cushion, we're using our whole body intelligence. Body, heart, and mind are activated in deep samadhi. See? And now we can understand the truth of who we really are and what our obstacles really might be. And we can begin the difficult task of understanding ourselves and dissolving our obstacles. This is the Buddha's way. See? So, practicing, studying sutras is not the same as practicing the Dharma. And practicing the Dharma is much more difficult because I'm sure you've noticed, just to bring it back to earth, the leaders of the New York, basically New York's two leading political figures, the leader of the Senate and the leader of the House of Representatives of the state of New York, in the last year have both gone to prison for lengthy prison terms. And when they get to prison, they will meet the previous leaders of the House and Senate. Maybe they'll share cells. Now, it's possible to say they're just bad apples, right? They're just bad apples. And that could be true. But, it's actually the case that they're all lawyers. And again, we all have thoughts about lawyers. But the thing is, you see, studying the law doesn't make you good. See, isn't that interesting? It should, right? Studying the law doesn't make you good. And in fact, studying even ethics. I've known professors of ethics who are terrible people. Studying ethics doesn't make you ethical. It doesn't. Confucius understood this too. He said, the way for people to become to all do the same thing isn't to have a law, it's to have a ritual where everybody does something together and it changes their hearts. It's a whole body practice. So, basically, having a law doesn't make you good. Having a rule doesn't make you follow it. Right? You have to have deep insight through cultivation of the self. I laughed when my student told me this, because he's gone to probably, 15, maybe 20 sesshin. When he sits like a rock. He's worked through many koans. I laugh because, he just doesn't understand what he's done. This is what it's all about, right? This is what it's all about. He is following the Buddha's way, and he doesn't even think he knows the Buddha's way. That might actually be a good thing. But Zen practice is based upon discovering for yourself the truth of the Dharma. See. So something like this koan, this is actually one of the hardest koans in the book, in the whole collection. A monk asked Tozan, "What is Buddha?" Tozan replied, 3 pounds of flax. Now, if you have that koan, first of all, you go back to your cushion and you sit down and you enter a bushin, you enter a blank mind, and you just say, you can just say 3 flax or 3 pounds if you want. You know, it helps maybe to know the story. So, you know, if you don't know what flax is, that could be a problem. So, you know, a flax is linen. And linen actually was probably discovered in China, believe it or not. And the way linen is sold is by the number of threads per square inch. So very, very expensive linen has many threads per square inch, like cotton. And coarse linen is much cruder. And actually burlap is like linen, actually, too, believe it or not. It's very coarse flax. So, you know, to make burlap into fine cloth, you have to take the burlap, the stalks of flax, the flax plant, and you beat them over combs, like giant combs. So people take the stalks of flax and they basically slap them through the teeth of this comb over and over again. And the more you comb it, the finer the flax. It's like the imperfections, the coarser material falls out, and the imperfections are combed away. And what you finally get is this very fine, all translucent golden fibers. So that would help to know. But then you go, you sit down on your cushion and you say, three flax, three flax, three flax, three flax. See, and you're waiting for something to happen. You know, now the way the koan works is that it's a subconscious or a subconscious cue. It's not going to speak to your discriminating mind, you know. When the Dalai Lama, I was reading the Dalai Lama, and the Dalai Lama says there's three different kinds of consciousness, okay? He says there's coarse consciousness. This coarse consciousness. And he says this is like very closely associated with bodily functions. So, you know, when you feel hungry, that's a very coarse kind of consciousness. You say, oh my God, I'm starving, you know. And then you get a piece of pizza and it's like, oh, that feels so good, right? Wow, I'll have another piece. That's coarse, coarse consciousness. You know, there's a finer kind of consciousness where you're no longer focused on your body and its needs. It's like the realm of ideas, right? The realm of ideas. So, you know, if you're doing calculus or something, or you're working on statistics, or you're reading poetry, you don't necessarily think about what's in your stomach, right? Or whether your feet hurt. You're like in this realm of pure ideas, right? That's a little bit more refined. Then there's a final kind of consciousness, which is very fine consciousness, right? This is the consciousness we enter in deep mushin. When our minds are completely blank and there's no thought, self-consciousness disappears, but there's a kind of awareness which is very, very subtle, very subtle. Many of you have been in that place. So this is the Dalai Lama says, the third and most refined, this is like the subtle body. You have a coarse body which craves pizza, and you have a fine body which has no physical aspects. It's your Dharma body. Okay. Now the Dalai Lama just told you that, and you can read it. You can read it. See? And you can think, ah, I understand the three bodies now. See? But you don't. You don't. You know, you have an intellectual understanding, but if you ran into the three bodies on the street, you wouldn't recognize them, so to speak. You know, the Zen approach isn't to tell you. It's to say, go look. And if you're in deep samadhi, and you're thinking, three flax, three flax, three flax, three flax, if you're in really deep samadhi, you'll find out something like what the Dalai Lama is telling you. See? But you'll find it for yourself, and you'll know it in your flesh and your bones. See? And you could say, oh, you just gave away the koan, but I didn't. I just gave you some more ideas. What does fine consciousness feel like? Be there and tell me about it. You can't do it right now, and you can't, if I said, how does fine consciousness look? What is the appearance of fine consciousness? What is the feeling of fine consciousness? What's the mood? You couldn't tell me. So you don't really know. Reading the Dalai Lama is wonderful, but it doesn't make you understand in your flesh and your bones. It's not real knowledge. See, and if somebody tells you something, it could sound logical, right? Somebody can tell you something that's logical, but that doesn't mean it's real, right? You have to find out for yourself when you discover it for yourself on the cushion, it's a totally different experience. So, Zen is based upon this idea that we can do it. We can liberate ourselves, and we are by practicing what the Buddha practiced. When the Buddha died, at the end of his life, he didn't say, study my words carefully and commit them to memory. He did not say that. He never says that. He never said that. He says, practice. He said, practice. And find the truth for yourself. He either said, be an island. In other words, you have to find it yourself. Or he said, you yourself are the light. You yourself are the light. Don't look anywhere else but in yourself. Actually, if you get here at 7 in the morning, we recite some verses. Atadipa. Atadipa. What does that mean? Atadipa. You are the light. You are the light. See? We go to a book when we don't feel like the light. You say, oh my God. I was at a meeting the other day and somebody talked about the Eightfold Path, and I knew nothing about it. I'm not a Buddhist. It's like, get a grip. You are the light. You are the light. Read the book if you want, but it's already there in you. The Buddha did not say, please do. I have read almost all the Pali Sutras. I've read all the major Zen Sutras. I read them multiple times. I love the Lotus Sutra so much. But you shouldn't have to read them to find this out, right? The sutras are all in you if you practice the Buddha's practice. So Zazen is what the Buddha taught. That is the way to liberate ourselves. He said, you are the light. Sit down on the mat, watch your breath. It's not easy to wake up. He didn't say it's easy. We all have our obstacles. It took the Buddha something like 6 years to wake up. See? And that's the Buddha. See? So the Buddha left home when he was 29, and he had his great awakening experience at 35. So, and that's with very diligent practice. Very diligent practice. So, if you want to wake up, that's what you should want, in my opinion. That's why we exist, is to wake up. You have to make an effort. It's not going to happen easily. If the Buddha took 6 years, it's probably going to take you more than 6 years. But actually, the good thing about this is, as the Buddha said, and it's so true, my path is beautiful at the beginning, beautiful in the middle, and beautiful at the end. So, if you if your obstacles get the better of you, you can have a miserable time. So if you have a koan and the teacher's giving you the koan and you can't answer the koan, you could make yourself really unhappy, right? You can say, oh my God, this is a failing grade on my report card, right? And you can feel like a failure. You can get angry. You can feel cheated. Those are all about you. Those are not about Zen. Those are your, that's your bullshit that you have to work through. See, the path itself is beautiful at the beginning, beautiful at the middle, beautiful at the end. When we sit down on the cushion and we inspect the sources of our suffering and they dissolve into emptiness, we are liberated. And we go through that process again and again and again, and we are deeply transformed into bodhisattvas. And we bodhisattvas are people on the road to becoming Buddhas. Now, it took the Buddha about 500 lifetimes to become a Buddha. But, so you can expect it to take more. But, it's a great way to live, right? Free from our fears, free from our illusions, free from our unhappiness. Zazen, this is a happy, happy, happy path if you work through your obstacles. Not everybody appreciates what I'm saying. I understand that. You know, the Courier News asked me to write a column on Buddhism, and I'm supposed to do it five times a year. So I write five columns a year, and I got an email from the editor, and he said, "I want you to write something on the Buddha's birthday, which is coming up." It is. It's the Buddha's birthday could be, like the 14th, I think, and it could be the 21st. And so it's like this: the Sri Lankans celebrate a Buddha's birthday on the 21st of May, and it's a lunar calendar, so it shifts around, like Jewish and Muslim days, holy days. This shifts around. So this year, according to like Sri Lankans, Cambodians, it's the 21st. The Chinese calculate it differently, and it could be the 14th. And then the Japanese celebrated on April 8th, because in the 19th century, a bunch of bureaucrats decided to fix the day. So they just picked that. And the editor wanted me to clear this mystery up. So I titled the article, "Happy No Birthday Buddha." And I said, it doesn't matter when his birthday was, right? Who cares? I said, you know, you have a life in time. It's made up of minutes and hours and years. You were born in 1985, and you will die in, 2185. Who knows? You live for X number of years. You are 5'7" or 5'8". You weigh X number of pounds. That's not everything. You know, we have on the cushion, when we sit down on the cushion, we have these moments where time disappears. You're just in this perfect moment, right? This perfect now. In Zen, it's called, you'll see it in the Zen literature, they say, just this. Pure presentness of the moment. There is no time. So I said, you know, who cares when the Buddha was born? What matters is this. This is what he taught. We have a life and time. We also have this other life, this bigger life. Those moments when we're 100% here, we feel 100% connected to the universe. That's what Buddhism is all about. So I typed it up. I thought it was great. And I sent it to the editor, and he was definitely not thrilled. But he's going to publish it anyway. But I could see he wanted me to clear up the mystery. So not everybody appreciates this perspective. Please read all the books that you want, but please do a lot of zazen. You know, it's a beautiful way to live. And most people feel better when they get off the cushion than when they sat down. At the very least, you're calmer and happier. And when you begin to work with your really big obstacles, you can be covered with sweat. It can take a lot. But at the end of the process, you're a much freer person than when you sat down. Much lighter and more buoyant, and that means you're more alive. A monk asked Tozan, "What is Buddha?" Tozan replied, "Three chin of flax." Mumon's comment: old Tozan attained the poor Zen of a clam. In other words, he was a very deep Zen master. He opened the two halves of the shell a little and exposed all the liver and intestines inside. In other words, he was completely unafraid to open himself up and look and inspect the sources of his responses to things. Totally willing to open himself up and work on himself. So he was like a clam who opened the shell a little and exposed the liver and intestines inside. But tell me, how do you see Tozan? In other words, he can't transfer his enlightenment to you. You have to achieve it yourself. You have to experience. The Dalai Lama can't transfer enlightenment to you. All his insight is just his insight. You have to find it on the cushion. Mumon's verse: 3 pounds of flax came sweeping along. Close were the words, but closer were the meanings. Those who argue about right and wrong are enslaved by right and wrong.